Aldis,
Volsibur says. I give him a sad smile. The High King doesn't know. And you're unlikely to tell him, once I cut out your tongue. Watching his fear ripen fills me with an almost voluptuous satisfaction. I, who have had little power in my life, must be on guard against that feeling. Power goes to my head too quickly, like fairy wine. Let me guess, I say, turning backward in my chair to face him, calculated coolness in my gaze. You thought you could strike me, and there would be no consequences. He shrinks a bit at my words.
What do you want?
Who says I want anything particular? I counter. Maybe just a little payback. As if we rehearsed it, the roach pulls out a particularly nasty blade from his belt and holds it over Volsibur. He grins down at the guard. The bomb looks up from her nails, a small smile on her lips as she watches the roach.
I guess the show is about to start.
Volsibur fights against his bonds, head lashing back and forth. I hear the wood of the chair crack, but he doesn't get free. After several heavy breaths, he slumps.
Please,
he whispers. I touch my chin as though a thought has just occurred to me. Or you could help us. Balekin wanted to make a bargain with Cardan. You could tell me about that.
I know nothing of it,
he says desperately. Too bad. I shrug and pick up another piece of cheese, shoving it into my mouth. He takes a look at the roach and the ugly knife.
But I know a secret. It's worth more than my life. More than whatever Balekin wanted with Cardan. If I tell it, will you give me your oath that I will leave here tonight, unharmed?
The roach looks at me and I shrug.
Well enough,
the roach says.
If the secret is all you claim, and if you'll swear never to reveal you had a visit to the Court of Shadows, then tell us, and we'll send you on your way.
The Queen of the Undersea,
Volsibur says, eager to speak now.
Her people crawl up the rocks at night and whisper to Balekin. They slip into the tower, although we don't know how, and leave him shells and shark teeth. Messages are being exchanged, but we can't decipher them. There are whispers. Orla intends to break her treaty with the land and use the information Balekin is giving her to ruin Cardan.
Of all the threats to Cardan's reign, the Undersea wasn't one I was expecting. The Queen of the Undersea has a single daughter, Nikasia, fostered on land and one of Cardan's awful friends. Like Locke, Nikasia and I have a history. Also like Locke, it isn't a good one. But I thought that Cardan's friendship with Nikasia meant Orla was happy he was on the throne. Next time one of these exchanges happen, I say, come straight to me. And if you hear anything else you think I'd be interested in, you come and tell me that, too.
That's not what we agreed,
Volsibur protests. True enough, I tell him. You've told us a tale, and it is a good one. We'll let you go tonight. But I can reward you better than some murderous prince who does not, and will never have, the High King's favor. There are better positions than guarding the Tower of Forgetting. Yours for the taking. There's gold. There's all the rewards that Balekin can promise, but is unlikely to deliver. He gives me a strange look, probably trying to judge whether, given that he hit me and I poisoned him, it is still possible for us to be allies.
You can lie,
he says finally.
I'll guarantee the rewards,
the roach says. He reaches over and cuts Volsibur's bindings with his scary knife.
Promise me a post other than in the tower,
says Volsibur, rubbing his wrists and pushing himself to his feet.
And I shall obey you as though you were the High King himself.
The bomb laughs at that, with a wink in my direction. They do not explicitly know that I have the power to command Cardin. But they know we have a bargain that involves my doing most of the work and the Court of Shadows acting directly for the Crown and getting paid directly, too.
I'm playing the High King in her little pageant,
Cardin said once in my hearing. The roach and the bomb laughed. The ghost didn't. Once Volzober exchanges promises with us, and the roach leads him, blindfolded, into the passageways out of the nest, the ghost comes to sit beside me.
Come spar,
he says, taking a piece of apple off my plate.
Burn off some of that simmering rage.
I give a little laugh. Don't disparage. It's not easy to keep the temperature so consistent, I tell him.
Nor so high,
he returns, watching me carefully with hazel eyes. I know there's human in his lineage. I can see it in the shape of his ears and his sandy hair. Unusual in fairy. But he hasn't told me his story. And here, in this place of secrets, I feel uncomfortable asking. Although the Court of Shadows does not follow me, the four of us have made a vow together. We have promised to protect the person and the office of the High King, to ensure the safety and the prosperity of Elfheim, for the hope of less bloodshed and more gold. So we've sworn. So they let me swear, even though my words don't bind me the way theirs do, by magic. I am bound by honor and by their faith in my having some.
The king himself has had audience with the roach thrice in this last fortnight. He's learning to pick pockets. If you're not careful, he'll make a better sly foot than you.
The ghost has been added to the High King's personal guard, which allows him to keep Cardin safe, but also to know his habits. I sigh. It's full dark, and I have much I ought to do before dawn. And yet, it is hard to ignore this invitation, which pricks at my pride. Especially now, with the new spies overhearing my answer. We recruited more members, displaced after the royal murders. Every prince and princess employed a few, and now we employ them all. The Spriggans are as cagey as cats, but excellent at ferreting out scandal. The Sparrow Boy is as green as I once was. I would like the expanding Court of Shadows to believe I don't back down from a challenge.
The real difficulty will come when someone tries to teach our king his way around a blade, I say, thinking of Baelkin's frustrations on that front, of Cardin's declaration that his one virtue was that he was no murderer. Not a virtue I share.
Oh,
says the ghost.
Maybe you'll have to teach it to him.
Come, I say, getting up. Let's see if I can teach you. At that, the ghost laughs outright. Madoc raised me to the sword. But until I joined the Court of Shadows, I knew only one way of fighting. The ghost has studied longer and knows far more. I follow him into the Milkwood, where black-thorned bees hum in their hives high in the white-barked trees. The root men are asleep. The sea laps at the rocky edges of the isle. The world feels hushed as we face each other. As tired as I am, my muscles remember better than I do. I draw Nightfall. The ghost comes at me fast, sword point diving toward my heart, and I knock it away, sweeping my blade down his side.
Not so out of practice as I feared,
he says as we trade blows, each of us testing the other. I do not tell him of the drills I do before the mirror, just as I do not tell him all the other ways I attempt to correct my defects. As the High King Seneschal and the de facto ruler, I have much to study. Military commitments, messages from vassals, demands from every corner of Elfheim written in as many languages. Only a few months ago, I was still attending lessons, still doing homework for scholars to correct. The idea that I can untangle everything seems as impossible as spinning straw into gold,
but each night I stay awake until the sun is high in the sky, trying my hardest to do just that. That's the problem with a puppet government. It's not going to run itself. Adrenaline may turn out not to be a replacement for experience. Done with testing me on the basics, the ghost begins the real fight. He dances over the grass lightly, so that there is barely a sound from his footfalls. He strikes and strikes again, posing a dizzying offensive. I parry desperately, my every thought given over to this, the fight. My worries fade into the background as my attention sharpens. Even my exhaustion blows off me like fluff from the head of a dandelion. It's glorious. We trade blows back and forth, advancing and retreating.
"Do you miss the mortal world?"
he asks. I'm relieved to discover his breath isn't coming entirely easily. "No," I say. "I hardly knew it." He attacks again, his sword a silvery fish darting through the sea of night.
"Watch the blade, not the soldier,"
Maddock told me many times.
"Steel never deceives."
Our weapons slam together again and again as we circle each other.
"You must remember something."
I think of my mother's name whispered through the bars in the tower. He feigns to one side and, distracted, I realize too late what he's doing. The flat of his blade hits my shoulder. He could have cut open my skin if he hadn't turned his blow at the last moment. And as it is, it's going to bruise. "Nothing important," I say, trying to ignore the pain. Two can play at the game of distraction. "Perhaps your memories are better than mine. What do you recall?" He shrugs.
"Like you, I was born there."
He stabs, and I block the blade.
"But things were different 100 years ago, I suppose."
I raise my eyebrows and parry another strike, dancing out of his range. "Were you a happy child?"
"I was magic. How could I fail to be?"
"Magic," I say, and with a twist of my blade, a move of Maddox's, I knock the sword out of the ghost's hand. He blinks at me, hazel eyes, crooked mouth opening in astonishment.
"You
got better," I supply, pleased enough not to mind my aching shoulder. It feels like a win, but if we were really fighting, that shoulder wound would have probably made my final move impossible. Still, his surprise thrills me nearly as much as my victory. "It's good Oak will grow up as we didn't," I say after a moment. "Away from the court. Away from all this." The last time I saw my little brother, he was sitting at the table in Vivi's apartment, learning multiplication as though it were a riddle game. He was eating string cheese. He was laughing.
"When the king returns,"
the ghost says, quoting from a ballad,
"rose petals will scatter across his path, and his footfalls will bring an end to wrath. But how will your Oak rule if he has as few memories of fairy as we have of the mortal world?"
The elation of the win ebbs. The ghost gives me a small smile, as though to draw the sting of his words. I go to a nearby stream and plunge my hands in, glad of the cold water. I cup it to my lips and gulp gratefully, tasting pine needles and silt. I think of Oak, an utterly normal fairy child, neither particularly called to cruelty, nor free of it, used to being coddled, used to being whisked away from distress by a fussing Oriana, now growing used to sugary cereal and cartoons and a life without treachery. I consider the rush of pleasure that I felt at my temporary triumph over the ghost, the thrill of being the power behind the throne, the worrying satisfaction I had at making Vulsalbur squirm. Is it better that Oak is without those impulses, or impossible for him to ever rule unless he has them? And now that I have found in myself a taste for power, will I be loath to give it up? I wipe wet hands over my face, pushing back those thoughts. There is only now. There is only tomorrow, and tonight, and now, and soon, and never. We start back, walking together as the dawn turns the sky gold. In the distance, I hear the bellow of a deer, and what sounds like drums. Halfway there, the ghost tips his head in a half bow.
You beat me tonight. I won't let that happen again.
If you say so, I tell him with a grin. By the time I get back to the palace, the sun is up, and I want nothing more than sleep. But when I make it to my apartments, I find someone standing in front of the door. My twin sister, Taryn. You've got a bruise coming up on your cheek, she says. The first words she's spoken to me in 5 months. Chapter 4. Taryn's hair is dressed with a halo of laurel, and her gown is a soft brown, woven through with green and gold. She has dressed to accentuate the curves of her hips and chest, both unusual and fairy, where bodies are thin to the point of attenuation. The clothes suit her, and there is something new in the set of her shoulders that suits her as well. She is a mirror, reflecting someone I could have been, but am not. It's late, I say clumsily, unlocking the door to my rooms. I didn't expect anyone to be up. It's well past dawn by now. The whole palace is quiet, and likely to stay so until the afternoon, when pages race through the halls and cooks light fires. Courtiers will rise from their beds much later, at full dark. For all my wanting to see her, now that she is in front of me, I am unnerved. She must want something, to have put in this effort all of a sudden. I've come twice before, she says, following me inside. You weren't here. This time, I decided to wait, even if I waited all day. I light the lamps, though it is bright outside. I am too deep in the palace to have windows in my rooms. You look well. She waves off my stiff politeness. Are we going to fight forever? I want you to wear a flower crown and dance at my wedding. Vivienne is coming from the mortal world. She's bringing Oak. Madoc promises he won't argue with you. Please say you'll come. Vivi is bringing Oak? I groan internally and wonder if there's a chance of talking her out of it. Maybe it's because she's my elder sister. But sometimes, it's hard for her to take me particularly seriously. I sink down on the couch, and Taryn does the same. I consider again the puzzle of her being here, of whether I should demand an apology, or if I should let her skip past all that, the way she clearly wants. Okay, I tell her, giving in. I've missed her too much to risk losing her again. For the sake of us being sisters, I will try to forget what it felt like to kiss Locke. For my own sake, I will try to forget that she knew about the games he was playing with me during their courtship. I will dance at her wedding, though I am afraid it will feel like dancing on knives. She reaches into the bag by her feet and pulls out my stuffed cat and snake.
Here, she says. I didn't think you meant to leave them behind.
They're relics of our old mortal life. Talismans. I take them and press them to my chest, as I might a pillow. Right now, they feel like reminders of all my vulnerabilities. They make me feel like a child playing a grown-up game. I hate her a little for bringing them. They're a reminder of our shared past. A deliberate reminder, as though she couldn't trust me to remember on my own. They make me feel all my exposed nerves when I am trying so hard not to feel anything. When I don't speak for a long moment, she goes on.
Madoc misses you too. You were always his favorite.
I snort. Vivi is his heir, his firstborn. The one he came to the mortal world to find. She's his favorite. Then there's you, who lives at home, and didn't betray him.
I'm not saying you're still his favorite, Taryn says with a laugh. Although, he was a little proud of you when you outmaneuvered him to get Cardin onto the throne, even if it was stupid. I thought you hated Cardin. I thought we both hated him.
I did, I say, nonsensically. I do. She gives me a strange look.
I thought you wanted to punish Cardin for everything he's done.
I think of his horror at his own desire when I brought my mouth to his. The dagger in my hand, edge against his skin. The toe-curling, corrosive pleasure of that kiss. It felt as though I was punishing him. Punishing him and myself at the same time. I hated him so much. Taryn is dredging up every feeling I want to ignore. Everything I want to pretend away. We made an agreement, I tell her, which is close to the truth. Cardin lets me be his advisor. I have a position and power, and Oak is out of danger. I want to tell her the rest, but I don't dare. She might tell Madoc, might even tell Locke. I cannot share my secrets with her, even to brag. And I admit that I desperately want to brag.
And in return, you gave him the crown of fairy.
Taryn is looking at me as though struck by my presumption. After all, who was I, a mortal girl, to decide who should sit on the throne of Elfheim? We get power by taking it. Little does she know how much more presumptuous I have been. I stole the crown of fairy, I want to tell her. The High King, Cardin, our old enemy, is mine to command. But of course I cannot say those words. Sometimes it seems dangerous even to think them. Something like that, I say instead.
It must be a demanding job, being his advisor.
She looks around the room, forcing me to see it as she does. I have taken over these chambers, but I have no servant save for the palace staff, whom I seldom allow inside. Cups of tea rest on bookshelves. Saucers lie on the floor along with dirty plates of fruit rinds and bread crusts. Clothes are scattered where I drop them after tugging them off. Books and papers rest on every surface.
You're unwinding yourself like a spool. What happens when there's no more thread?
Then I spin more, I say, carrying the metaphor.
Let me help you, she says, brightening.
My brows rise.
You want to make thread?
She rolls her eyes at me.
Oh, come on. I can do things you don't have time for. I see you in court. You have perhaps 2 good jackets. I could bring some of your old gowns and jewels over. Madoc wouldn't notice. And even if he did, he wouldn't mind.
Fairy runs on debt, on promises and obligations. Having grown up here, I understand what she's offering. A gift, a boon, instead of an apology. I have 3 jackets, I say. She raises both brows.
Well, then I guess you're all set.
I can't help wondering at her coming now, just after Locke has been made Master of Revels, and with her still in Madoc's house. I wonder where her political loyalties lie. I am ashamed of those thoughts. I don't want to think of her the way I have to think about everyone else. She is my twin, and I missed her, and I hoped she would come. And now she has. Okay, I say. If you want to, bringing over my old stuff would be great.
Good, Taryn stands. And you ought to acknowledge what an enormous act of forbearance it was for me not to ask where you came from tonight or how you got hurt.
At that, My smile is instant and real. She reaches out a finger to pet the plush body of my stuffed snake.
I love you, you know. Just like Mr. Hiss. And neither of us wants to be left behind.
Good night, I tell her. And when she kisses my bruised cheek, I hug her to me. Brief and fierce. Once she's gone, I take my stuffed animals and seat them next to me on the rug. Once, they were a reminder that there was a time before Fairyland, when things were normal. Once, they were a comfort to me. I take a long last look, and then, one by one, I feed them to the fire. I'm no longer a child, and I don't need comfort. Once that is done, I line up little shimmering glass vials in front of me. Mithridatism, it is called. The process by which one takes a little bit of poison to inoculate oneself against a full dose of it. I started a year ago. Another way for me to correct my defects. There are still side effects. My eyes shine too brightly. The half moons of my fingernails are bluish, as though my blood doesn't get quite enough oxygen. My sleep is strange, full of too vivid dreams. A drop of the blood-red liquid of the blusher mushroom, which causes potentially lethal paralysis. A petal of death sweet, which can cause a sleep that lasts 100 years. A sliver of wraithberry, which makes the blood race and induces a kind of wildness before stopping the heart. And a seed of everapple, fairy fruit, which muddies the minds of mortals. I feel dizzy and a little sick when the poison hits my blood, but I would be sicker still if I skipped a dose. My body has acclimated, and now it craves what it should revile. Inapt metaphor for other things. I crawl to the couch and lie there. As I do, Baelkin's words wash over me. I have heard that for mortals, the feeling of falling in love is very like the feeling of fear. Your heart beats fast. Your senses are heightened. You grow lightheaded, maybe even dizzy. Is that right? I am not sure I sleep, but I do dream. Chapter 5. I am tossing fitfully in a nest of blankets and papers and scrolls on the rug before the fire when the ghost wakes me. My fingers are stained with ink and wax. I look around, trying to recall when I got up, what I was writing, and to whom. The roach stands in the open panel of the secret passageway into my rooms, watching me with his reflecting, inhuman eyes. My skin is sweaty and cold. My heart races. I can still taste poison, bitter and cloying on my tongue.
He's at it again,
the ghost says. I do not have to ask whom he means. I may have tricked Cardan into wearing the crown, but I have not yet learned the trick of making him behave with the gravitas of a king. While I was off getting information, he was off with Locke. I knew there would be trouble. I scrub my face with the calloused heel of my hand. I'm up, I say. Still in my clothes from the night before, I brush off my jacket and hope for the best. Walking into my bedroom, I scrape my hair back, knotting it with a bit of leather and covering the mess with a velvet cap. The roach frowns at me.
You're wrinkled. His Majesty isn't supposed to go around with a seneschal who looks like she just rolled out of bed.
Velmorin had sticks in his hair for the last decade, I remind him, taking a few partially dried mint leaves from my cabinet and chewing on them to take the staleness from my breath. The last High King Seneschal was mortal, as I am, fond of somewhat unreliable prophecy, and widely considered to be mad. Probably the same sticks. The roach harumphs.
Velmorin's a poet. Rules are different for poets.
Ignoring him, I follow the ghost into the secret passage that leads to the heart of the palace, pausing only to check that my knives are still tucked away in the folds of my clothes. The ghost's footfalls are so silent that when there's not enough light for my human eyes to see, I might as well be entirely alone. The roach does not follow us. He heads in the opposite direction with a grunt. Where are we going? I ask the darkness.
His apartment,
the ghost tells me as we emerge into a hall, a staircase below where Cardin sleeps.
There's been some kind of disturbance.
I have difficulty imagining what trouble the High King got into in his own rooms, but it doesn't take long to discover. When we arrive, I spot Cardin resting among the wreckage of his furniture. Curtains ripped from their rods, the frames of paintings cracked, their canvases kicked through, furniture broken. A small fire smolders in a corner, and everything stinks of smoke and spilled wine. Nor is he alone. On a nearby couch are Locke and two beautiful fairies, a boy and a girl, one with ram's horns, the other with long ears that come to tufted points, like those of an owl. All of them are in an advanced state of undress and inebriation. They watch the room burn with a kind of grim fascination. Servants cower in the hall, unsure if they should brave the king's wrath and clean up. Even his guards seem intimidated. They stand awkwardly in the hall outside his massive doors, one barely hanging from its hinges, ready to protect the High King from any threat that isn't himself. Cardin, I remember myself, and sink into a bow. Your infernal majesty. He turns and, for a moment, seems to look through me, as though he has no idea who I am. His mouth is painted gold, and his pupils are large with intoxication. Then his lip lifts in a familiar sneer.
You.
Yes, I say. Me. He gestures with a wineskin.
Have a drink.
His wide-sleeved linen hunting shirt hangs open. His feet are bare. I guess I should be glad he's wearing pants. I have no head for liquor, my lord, I say, entirely truthfully, narrowing my eyes in warning.
Am I not your king?
He asks, daring me to contradict him, daring me to refuse him. Obediently, because we are in front of people, I take the skin and tip it against my closed lips, pretending to take a long swallow. I can tell he's not fooled, but he doesn't push it. Everyone else may leave us. I indicate the fairies on the couch, including Locke. You, move. Now. The two I do not know turn toward Cardin beseechingly, but he barely seems to notice them and does not countermand me. After a long moment, they sulkily unfold and see themselves out through the broken door. Locke takes longer to get up. He smiles at me as he goes, an insinuating smile that I can't believe I ever found charming. He looks at me as though we share secrets, although we don't. We don't share anything. I think of Taryn, waiting in my rooms, as this merriment began. I wonder if she could hear it. I wonder if she's used to staying up late with Locke, watching things burn. The ghost shakes his sandy head at me, eyes bright with amusement. He is in palace livery. To the knights in the hall and anyone else who might be looking, he is just another member of the High King's personal guard.
I'll make sure everyone stays where they're put,
the ghost says, leaving through the doorway and issuing what sounds like orders to the other knights. Well? I say, looking around. Cardin shrugs, sitting on the newly unoccupied couch. He picks at a piece of horsehair stuffing that is sticking out through the torn fabric. His every movement is languorous. It feels dangerous to rest my gaze on him for too long, as though he is so thoroughly debauched that it might be contagious.
There were more guests, he says,
like that's any explanation.
They left.
I can't imagine why, I say, voice as dry as I can make it.
They told me a story,
Cardin says.
Would you like to hear it? Once upon a time, there was a human girl, stolen away by fairies. And because of that, she swore to destroy them.
Wow, I say. That really is a testament to how much you suck as a king, to believe your reign is capable of destroying fairy. Still, the words unnerve. I don't want my motives to be considered. I ought not to be thought of as influential. I ought not to be thought of at all. The ghost returns from the hall, leaning the door against the frame, closing it as much as is possible. His hazel eyes are shadowed. I turn back to Cardin. That little story is not why I was sent for. What happened?
This,
he says, and staggers into the room with a bed in it. There, embedded deeply in the splintered wood of the headboard, are two black bolts. You're mad that one of your guests shot your bed, I guess? He laughs.
They weren't aiming for the bed.
He pulls aside his shirt, and I see the hole in the cloth and a stripe of raw skin along his side. My breath catches.
Who did this?
The ghost demands, and then, looking more closely at Cardin.
And why aren't the guards outside more upset? They don't behave as though they failed to prevent an assassination attempt.
Cardin shrugs.
I believe the guards think I was taking aim at my guests.
I take a step closer and notice a few drops of blood on one of the disarranged pillows. There are a few scattered white flowers, too, seeming to grow out of the fabric. Did someone else get hit? He nods.
The bolt hit her leg, and she was screaming and not making very much in the way of sense. So you see how someone might conclude that I shot her when no one else was around. The actual shooter went back into the walls.
He narrows his eyes at the ghost and me, tilting his head, accusation burning in his gaze.
There seems to be some sort of secret passageway.
The Palace of Elfheim is built into a hill, with High King Eldred's old apartments at the very center, their walls crawling with roots and blooming vines. The whole court assumed that Cardin would take those, but he moved to the farthest place possible from them, at the very peak of the hill, with crystal panes set into the earth like windows. Before his coronation, they had belonged to the least favored of the royal household. Now the residents of the palace scramble to rearrange themselves so they can be closer to the new High King. And Eldred's rooms? Abandoned, and too grand for anyone else to rightfully claim, remain empty. I know of only a few ways into Cardin's rooms. A single, large, thick-glassed window enchanted never to break. A pair of double doors and, apparently, a secret passage. It's not on the map of tunnels we have, I tell him.
Ah,
he says. I'm not sure he believes me. Did you see who shot at you? And why didn't you tell your own guards what really happened? I demand. He gives me an exasperated look.
I saw a blur of black. And as to why I didn't correct the guards, I was protecting you and the Court of Shadows. I didn't think you would want the whole royal guard in your secret passageways.
To that, I have no answer. The disturbing thing about Cardin is how well he plays the fool to disguise his own cleverness. Opposite the bed is a cabinet built into the wall, taking the whole length of it. It has a painted clock face on the front, with constellations instead of numbers. The arms of the clock are pointed toward a configuration of stars, prophesying a particularly amorous lover. Inside, it appears merely a wardrobe, overstuffed with Cardin's clothes. I pull them out, letting them fall to the floor in a pile of velvet cuffs, satin, and leather. From the bed, Cardin makes a sound of mock distress. I press my ear to the wood backing, listening for the whistle of wind and feeling for a draft. The ghost does the same on the other side. His fingers find a latch, and a thin door springs open. Although I knew the palace was riddled with passageways, I never would have dreamed one was in Cardin's very bedroom. And yet, I should have combed over every inch of wall. I could have, at the least, asked one of the other spies to do so. But I avoided it, because I avoided being alone with Cardin. "Stay with the king," I tell the ghost, and picking up a candle, head into the darkness beyond the wall, avoiding being alone with him again. The tunnel is dim, lit throughout with golden hands holding torches that burn with a smokeless green flame. The stone floor is covered in a threadbare carpet, a strangely decorative detail for a secret passageway. A few feet in, I find the crossbow. It is not the compact thing that I have carried. It's massive, more than half my size, obviously dragged here. I can see the way the carpet is rucked up in the direction whence it came. Whoever shot it from here. I jump over and keep going. I would expect a passageway like this to have many branches, but this one has none. It dips down at intervals, like a ramp, and turns in on itself. But it runs in only one direction, straight ahead. I hurry, faster and faster, my hand cupped around my candle flame to keep it from going out. Then I come to a heavy wooden slab carved with the royal crest, the same one stamped in Cardin's signet ring. I give it a push, and it shifts, clearly on a track. There's a bookshelf on the other side. Until now, I have only heard stories of the great majesty of High King Eldred's rooms in the very heart of the palace. Just above the Buddha, the great branches of the throne itself snaking through his walls. Although I've never seen them before, the descriptions make it impossible to think I am anywhere else. I walk through the enormous, cavernous rooms of Eldred's apartments, candle in one hand, a knife in the other. And there, sitting on the High King's bed, her face stained with tears, is Nikasia, Orla's daughter, princess of the undersea, fostered in the High King's court as part of the decades-ago treaty of peace between Orla and Eldred. Nikasia was once part of the foursome made up of Cardin and his closest, most awful friends. She was also his beloved, until she betrayed him for Locke. I haven't seen her by Cardin's side as often since he ascended to the throne, but ignoring her hardly seems like a killing offense. Is this what Baelkin was whispering about with the Undersea? Is this the way Cardin was to be ruined? "You?" I shout. "You shot Cardin? Don't tell him." She glares at me furiously, wiping wet eyes. "And put away that knife." Nikasia wears a robe, heavily embroidered with phoenixes and wrapped tightly around herself. Three earrings shine along her lobes, snaking up the ears all the way to their bluish webbed points. Her hair has gotten darker since I saw it last. It was always the many colors of the sea, but now it is the sea in a storm, a deep greenish black. "Are you out of your mind?" I yell. "You tried to assassinate the High King of Faerie." "I didn't," she says. "I swear. I only meant to kill the girl he was with." For a moment, I am too stunned by the cruelty and indifference to speak. I take another look at her, at the robe she's clutching so tightly. With her words echoing in my head, I suddenly have a clear idea of what happened. You thought to surprise him in his rooms. Yes, she says. But he wasn't alone, I continue, hoping she will take up the tale. When I saw the crossbow on the wall, it didn't seem it would be so difficult to aim, she says, forgetting the part about dragging it up through the passageway. Though it's heavy and awkward, and that couldn't have been easy. I wonder how angry she was, how unthinking in her rage. Of course, perhaps she was thinking entirely clearly. It's treason, you know, I say aloud. I am shaking, I realize. The after effects of believing someone tried to assassinate Cardin, of realizing he could have died. They'll execute you. They'll make you dance yourself to death in iron shoes heated hot as pokers. You'll be lucky if they put you in the tower for getting. I am the princess of the undersea, she says haughtily. But I can see the shock on her face as my words register. Exempt from the laws of the land. Besides, I told you I wasn't aiming for him. Now I understand the worst of her behavior in school. She thought she could never be punished. Have you ever used a crossbow before? I ask. You put his life at risk. He could have died. You idiot! He could have died! I told you. She starts to repeat herself. Yes, yes, the compact between the sea and the land, I interrupt her, still furious. But it just so happens, I know that your mother is intent on breaking the treaty. You see, she will say it was between Queen Orla and High King Eldred, not Queen Orla and High King Cardin. It doesn't apply any longer. Which means it won't protect you. At that, Nikasia gapes at me, afraid for the first time. How did you know that? I wasn't sure, I think. Now I am. Let's assume I know everything, I tell her instead. Everything, always. Yet, I'm willing to make a deal with you. I'll tell Cardin and the guards and the rest of them that the shooter got away. If you do something for me. Yes, she says, before I even lay out the conditions, making the depth of her desperation clear. For a moment, a desire for vengeance rises in me. Once, she laughed at my humiliation. Now, I could gloat before hers. This is what power feels like. Pure, unfettered power. It's great. Tell me what Orla is planning, I say, pushing those thoughts away. I thought you knew everything already, she returns sulkily, shifting so she can rise from the bed, one hand still clutching her robe. I guess she is wearing very little, if anything, underneath. You should have just gone in, I want to tell her suddenly. You should have told him to forget the other girl. Maybe he would have. Do you want to buy my silence or not? I ask, sitting down on the edge of the cushions. We have only a certain amount of time before someone comes looking for me. If they see you, it will be too late for denials. Nikasia gives a long, suffering sigh. My mother says he is a young and weak king. That he lets others influence him too much. With that, she gives me a hard look. She believes he will give in to her demands. If he does, then nothing will change. And if he doesn't? Her chin comes up. Then the truce between land and sea will be over, and it will be the land that suffers. The Isles of Elfheim will sink beneath the waves. And then what? I ask. Cardin is unlikely to make out with you if your mom floods the place. You don't understand. She wants us to be married. She wants me to be queen. I am so surprised that, for a moment, I just stare at her, fighting down a kind of wild, panicky laughter.
You just shot him!
The look she gives me is beyond hatred.
Well, you murdered Valerian, did you not? I saw him the night he disappeared, and he was talking about you. Talking about paying you back for stabbing him. People say he died at the coronation, but I don't think he did.
Valerian's body is buried on Maddox's estate, beside the stables, and if it was unearthed, I would have heard about it before now. She's guessing. And so what if I did anyway? I am at the right hand of the High King of Faerie. He can pardon my every crime. Still, the memory of it brings back the terror of fighting for my life. And it reminds me how she would have delighted in my death the way she delighted in everything Valerian did or tried to do to me. The way she delighted in Cardin's hatred. Next time you catch me committing treason, you can force me to tell you my secrets, I say. But right now, I'd rather hear what your mother intends to do with Baelkin.
Nothing,
Nikasia says. And here I thought the folk couldn't lie, I tell her. Nikasia paces the room. Her feet are in slippers, the points of which curl up like ferns.
I'm not. Mother believes Cardin will agree to her terms. She's just flattering Baelkin. She lets him believe he's important, but he won't be. He won't.
I try to piece the plot together. Because he's her backup plan if Cardin refuses to marry you? My mind is reeling with the certainty that above all else, I cannot allow Cardin to marry Nikasia. If he did, it would be impossible to prize both of them from the throne. Oak would never rule. I would lose everything. Her gaze narrows.
I've told you enough.
You think we're still playing some kind of game, I say.
Everything's a game, Jude, she says. You know that. And now, it's your move.
With those words, she heads toward the enormous doors and heaves one open.
Go ahead and tell them if you want. But you should know this. Someone you trust has already betrayed you.
I hear the slap of her slippers on stone, and then the heavy slam of wood against the frame. My thoughts are a riot of confusion as I make my way back through the passageway. Cardin is waiting for me in the main room of his chambers, reclining on a couch with a shrewd look on his face. His shirt is still open, but a fresh bandage covers his wound. Across his fingers, a coin dances. I recognize the trick as one of the roaches. Someone you trust has already betrayed you. From the shattered remains of the door, the ghost looks in from where he stands with the High King's personal guard. He catches my eye.
Well, Cardin asks, have you discovered aught of my erstwhile murderer?
I shake my head, not quite able to give speech to the lie. I look around at the wreckage of these rooms. There is no way for them to be secure. And they reek of smoke. Come on, I say, taking Cardin's arm and pulling him unsteadily to his feet. You can't sleep here.
What happened to your cheek?
He asks, his gaze focusing blurrily on me. He's close enough that I can see his long lashes, the gold ring around the black of his iris. Nothing, I say. He lets me squire him into the hall. As we emerge, the ghost and the rest of the guards move immediately to stand at attention.
At ease, says Cardin with a wave of his hand. My seneschal is taking me somewhere. Worry not. I'm sure she's got a plan of some kind.
His guards fall in line behind us, some of them frowning, as I half lead him, half carry him, to my chambers. I hate taking him there. But I do not feel confident about his safety anywhere else. He looks around in amazement, taking in the mess,
Where do you really sleep here? Perhaps you ought to set fire to your rooms as well.
Maybe, I say, guiding him to my bed. It is strange to put my hand on his back. I can feel the warmth of his skin through the thin linen of his shirt. Can feel the flex of his muscles. It feels wrong to touch him as though he were a regular person. As though he weren't both the High King and also my enemy. He needs no encouragement to sprawl on my mattress, head on the pillow, black hair spilling like crow feathers. He looks up at me with his night-colored eyes, beautiful and terrible, all at once.
For a moment, he says, I wondered if it wasn't you shooting bolts at me.
I make a face at him. And what made you decide it wasn't? He grins up at me.
They missed.
I have said that he has the power to deliver a compliment and make it hurt. So too can he say something that ought to be insulting and deliver it in such a way that it feels like being truly seen. Our eyes meet, and something dangerous sparks. He hates you, I remind myself.
Kiss me again,
he says, drunk and foolish.
Kiss me until I am sick of it.
I feel those words, feel them like a kick to the stomach. He sees my expression and laughs, a sound full of mockery. I can't tell which of us he's laughing at. He hates you. Even if he wants you, he hates you. Maybe he hates you the more for it. After a moment, his eyes flutter closed. His voice falls to a whisper, as though he's talking to himself.
If you're the sickness, I suppose you can't also be the cure.
He drifts off to sleep. But I am wide awake. Chapter 6. All through the morning I sit on a chair tipped back against the wall of my own bedroom. My father's sword is across my lap. My mind keeps going over Nikasia's words. You don't understand. She wants us to be married. She wants me to be queen. Though I am across the floor from him, my gaze strays often to the bed and to the boy sleeping there. His black eyes closed, his dark hair spilling over my pillow. At first, he could not seem to get comfortable, tangling his feet in the sheets. But eventually, his breathing smoothed out, and so did his movements. He is as ridiculously beautiful as ever, mouth soft, lips slightly parted. Lashes so long that when his eyes are closed, they rest against his cheek. I am used to Cardin's beauty, but not to any vulnerability. It feels uncomfortable to see him without his fanciful clothes, without his acid tongue and malicious gaze for armor. Over the 5 months of our arrangement, I have tried to anticipate the worst. I have issued commands to prevent him from avoiding, ignoring, or getting rid of me. I figured out rules to prevent mortals from being tricked into years-long servitude and gotten him to proclaim them. But it never seems like enough. I recall walking with him in the gardens of the palace at dusk. Cardin's hands were clasped behind his back, and he stopped to sniff the enormous globe of a white rose, tipped with scarlet, just before it snapped at the air. He grinned and lifted an eyebrow at me, but I was too nervous to smile back. Behind him, at the edge of the garden, were a half dozen knights, his personal guard, to which the ghost was already assigned. Although I went over and over what I was about to tell him, I still felt like the fool who believes she can trick a dozen wishes from a single one if she just gets the phrasing right. I am going to give you orders.
Oh, indeed,
he said. On his brow, the gold crown of Elfheim caught the light of the sunset. I took a breath and began. You are never to deny me an audience or give an order to keep me from your side.
Why so ever would I want you to leave my side?
He asked.